And welcome to today's City Club of Boise program, The Impacts of Redlining on Health, Wealth, and Housing. I'm Jen Schneider, a member of the City Club's Forums Committee and today's moderator. Attendees, please note that the video or audio will not be available from your computers. We'll only be seeing and hearing from our panelists. I want to welcome our radio listeners who will be joining us at a later date via Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout Southern Idaho and Northern Nevada. Today's forum is available for our audience in large part because of our City Club partners and sponsors. I would like to take time to thank a few of these organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engage citizens, and a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. We also receive support from our forum series sponsors, AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mine Development. City Club of Boise receives grant funding from the Idaho Humanities Council. Thanks also to our media partners, which include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman and Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, U of I, Boise State, and NNU. So it's my great pleasure to introduce our panelists to you today. Adam Briones is with the Greenlining Institute, where he leads the banking, housing, and economic development work. Prior to joining Greenlining, Adam was most recently a vice president of real estate development at the Genesis Companies in New York, one of the city's most active African-American-owned affordable housing developers. Adam has deep experience in acquisition, financing, rehabilitation, and management of 52 affordable rental and home ownership buildings, as well as public-private development partnerships and market, financial, and deal structure analyses. Adam joins us today from the Bay Area. LaTanya Haney-Keith currently serves on the senior leadership team of the College of Idaho as Vice President of High Impact Practices. Through this role, Vice President Haney-Keith is responsible for creating and implementing an innovative new program that blurs the lines between college and careers. Vice President Haney-Keith joined the college from Concordia University School of Law, where she served most recently as Interim Dean and Associate Dean of Academics. Prior to joining Concordia Law, Vice President Haney-Keith spent nearly 7 years running a worldwide pro bono practice at a large law firm based in Chicago. Vice President Haney-Keith also regularly conducts trainings on recognizing and reducing implicit biases and has published scholarship on the topic of bias, discrimination, and harassment in the legal profession. And last but not least is Shannon McGuire. Shannon is a locally recognized leader in community health and brings a diverse view and experience to the challenges surrounding food systems. Shannon has a strong passion for food because of its dramatic effects on our social, environmental, economic, and human development. Whether it's urban farms, childhood obesity, food cooperatives, plant-based eating, or building food education and empowerment destinations, Shannon is working to bring food to the forefront of the conversation. In 2017, Shannon was inducted into the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Culture of Health Leaders Program. Shannon serves on the Boise Co-op as board president and is chief empowerment officer at Spark Strategic Solutions, LLC. We're going to do things a little bit different today for City Club of Boise because we recognize that a lot of our members and folks in the audience may not be familiar with redlining. And so we wanted to provide the panelists an opportunity to provide some background into what redlining is and how it functions. So LaTanya, we're going to start with you. You're going to provide us with some of the history of redlining and talk to us about the policies of redlining in the United States.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jen. And thanks to the City Club of Boise for inviting us to discuss this important issue. We thought, as Jen mentioned, that we would start with providing some historical context and an understanding of terminology. And then as understanding the topic of redlining is really greatly aided by visual representation, we wanted to share some maps with you that demonstrate the process and impact of redlining. And then we thought we would turn to localizing the topic and discussing its prevalence here, right here in Boise. So as we only have an hour today, our historical overview will be heavily summarized, but it is important to understanding the impact of redlining on our cities, and in particular in our communities of color. Next slide, please. So this phenomenon really started as a response to the housing shortage following the Great Depression, you know, as a means of increasing America's housing stock and responding to the economic and foreclosure crisis. The Roosevelt administration created the Homeowners Loan Corporation in June of 1933, and this was part of the New Deal. And HOLC purchased distressed mortgages from banks and then negotiated new, more affordable mortgages with the homeowner. And before it ran out of capital, which it did in 1935, the HOLC purchased a little more than a million mortgages, or about 20%, predominantly urban home mortgages. However, during its short history, it helped begin to segregate the United States in the manner and through the manner in which it issued housing loans, which was through redlining. And this term redlining comes from the federal government's use of maps for every metropolitan area in the country, where they color coded first by the HOLC and then by the Federal Housing Administration, which was launched in 1934. And then it was also adopted by the Veterans Administration. And these color codes were designed to indicate where it was safe to insure mortgages. And unfortunately, anywhere where African Americans lived or anywhere where African Americans lived nearby, they were colored red. And this was to indicate to appraisers that these neighborhoods were too risky to insure mortgages. And this perspective was grounded in the work of two individuals. The first is real estate expert Frederick Babcock, who helped start the Federal Housing Administration. In 1932, he wrote The Valuation of Real Estate, which proposed a segregationist housing valuation policy. He really argued that declines in property values could be, quote, partially avoided by segregation, and this device has always been in common usage in the South, where white and Negro populations have been separated. The second individual is Homer Hoyt, the first chief housing economist for the FHA, whose 1934 dissertation perfected a system of ranking races and nationalities in order of desirability. And this was to illustrate their beneficial effect or negative impact on land values. So Hoyt ranked Anglo-Saxons and Northern Europeans as most desirable or favorable, and ranked Northern Italians, Polish communities, Greek communities, and Southern Italians and, quote, Negroes and Mexicans as part of the lowest classes. So Babcock and Hoyt are credited with establishing the first underwriting manual for the FHA in 1936. And that underwriting manual was really grounded in the philosophy that incompatible racial groups should not be permitted to live in the same communities. So this means that loans to African Americans and other communities of color could not be insured. The underwriting manual promoted the use of racially restricted covenants, right? This is in our deed, putting in restrictions that say that they need to be prohibited to what the time was viewed as the race of which those neighborhoods were intended. And that inharmonious racial groups or incompatible racial elements were the terms of art for the day, and that those would cause devaluation of a neighborhood. The underwriting manual was also quite famous for recommending that highways would be a good way to separate African American from white neighborhoods. So from 1934 to 1968, the Federal Housing Administration furthered segregation efforts by refusing to insure mortgages in or near African American neighborhoods. But at the same time, the FHA was subsidizing builders who were mass producing entire subdivisions for Caucasian communities, with the requirement that none of the homes be sold to African Americans. So in essence, the FHA made home ownership accessible to Caucasian people by guaranteeing their loans, but explicitly refusing to back loans to African American people or even other communities who lived near African American communities. So this justification was that if African Americans bought homes in suburbs, for example, that the property values of the homes that the FHA was insuring would decline and their loans would be at risk. But it has been shown that there's no basis or evidence to support that claim. And in fact, many historians have evaluated that when African Americans tried to buy homes in all-white neighborhoods, property values actually increased because African Americans were more willing to pay for properties than whites were, simply because their housing supply was so restricted and they had so few choices at that time. So as Richard Rothstein eloquently articulates in his book, The Color of Law, and if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. It's fantastic. But the long-term effects of African Americans being prohibited from buying homes in suburbs, particularly, has being able to build equity has really been detrimental to the African American community. So today, African American incomes average about 60% of average white incomes, but African American wealth is about 5% of white wealth. So most middle-class families in this country gain their wealth from equity that they have in their homes. So Rothstein argues in his book that the enormous difference between a 60% income ratio and a 5% wealth ratio is almost entirely attributable to the federal housing policy implemented through the 20th century. So in other words, because African Americans were prohibited from buying homes in the suburbs in the 1940s, in the 1950s, and even into the 1960s, they gained none of the equity appreciation that Caucasians gained. During those years, homes sold for about twice the national median income, and therefore they were affordable to working class Americans, including African American working class families. But because the FHA and the VA refused to extend loans to African American families, wealth accumulation was effectively denied to this entire community. So today, some of those same homes sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 at a minimum, which is now 6 to 8 times the national median income. So as we can see, this concept of wealth accumulation, right, it really allowed Caucasian families to send their children to college with their home equities or to bequeath their wealth to their children. It's really allowed for social mobility, even for lower or moderate income white families. But those opportunities were denied to African American families. So though the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968, and this essentially dismantled the practice of redlining, it was really too late. By that time, homes were no longer affordable to the families that could have afforded them if they were able to have purchased them in the 40s and in the 50s. But unfortunately, the story does not end there. And while redlining effectually ended, inequitable lending practice continued even after the passage of the Fair Housing Act. And as we've now entered into the 21st century, we saw the emergence of a new term, which is reverse redlining. Okay, reverse redlining involves targeting residents with a certain geographic boundaries, usually based on income or race or ethnicity, and giving those targeted borrowers credit on unfair terms. And this has become what we've heard in popular media as being subprime loans. And the proliferation of subprime lending at the turn of the century led to another dramatic uptick in foreclosure rates. And those borrowing under subprime loans, which were predominantly communities of color, were 8 times as likely to default as their counterparts who were borrowing under conventional prime loans. And these foreclosures in turn then led to the housing market crash around 2008 and consequently disproportionately drained the savings and intergenerational wealth of African American families and other communities of color. The Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Sean Donovan, remarked that because of Countrywide, was one of the big examples right at the time, and other lenders' practices, he stated, quote, "Between 2005 and 2009, fully two-thirds of median household wealth in Hispanic families was wiped out. And from Jamaica Plains, New York to Oakland, California, strong middle-class African-American neighborhoods saw nearly 2 decades of gains reversed in a matter of not years, but months." And unfortunately, the consequences of racially targeted subprime lending continue to accumulate. Low and moderate income households, especially communities of color, no longer qualify for conventional mortgages because they've previously defaulted when they were unable to make exorbitant loan payments on their subprime loan. And now they only qualify for mortgages under a contract buying scheme, in which they're sold property under high interest rates, with high down payments, with no equity accumulated until the contract period has ended, and with eviction if possible after a single missed payment. So lastly, now we're bringing it up to 2020, right? With the COVID-19 pandemic struck, right? Many of the families that we're talking about still haven't covered from the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis. And as a result, Black and Latinx families today, for example, remain significantly more likely than their white counterparts to endure housing cost burdens that exceed 30% of their income, rendering many other expenses unaffordable and still making that savings, that wealth accumulation, even more difficult. And in light of the pandemic, and we'll talk a little bit more about health impacts, but the additional impacts on our economy and employment that we're seeing, our country now finds itself on the precipice of another national housing crisis. We have an estimated 30 to 40 million Americans could face eviction in the coming months, with the federal eviction moratorium set to expire at the end of this year, and with prospects of a second coronavirus relief package uncertain. But this nationwide upsurge in this housing insecurity has not hit all Americans equally. Black Americans, who are already disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus, are especially at risk of losing their homes. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Adam, who will share with us some of the maps of how redlining has developed and talk a little bit more about some of the zoning implications as well. Matt, Adam?
Great. Thank you so much, LaTanya. I'm really appreciative of what I think was an excellent introduction to redlining, and really so appreciative of how you tied, what started almost 100 years ago and the reverberations that are happening today. So let me go ahead and start with my first slide. Really quickly, again, my name is Adam Briones. I'm the Director of Economic Equity at the Greenlining Institute. We're based in Oakland, California. We're about 30 years old. And really, my organization, Greenlining, was founded directly in response to, historic discrimination around redlining. And really, the mission and vision of our organization is to help further a nation where communities of color can live in a world where race is never a barrier to economic opportunity. And really, before we can talk about the vision of greenlining, of course, we have to talk about the historic impact of redlining. Next slide, please. So I'm starting out with two maps. One on the left is, and of course, I'll just go ahead and give a disclaimer. If you're listening to this on the radio, this is going to get a little dull because these are all visuals that we'll be going over for the next 5 minutes or so. But for those of you that can see the presentation, on the left side is a redlining homeowners loan corporation map of Brooklyn, New York. On the right side is Oakland, California. Brooklyn is where I spent the past decade working in affordable housing. And Oakland on the right side is where I was born and where I currently live. So, as you can see, these two areas that are, on different ends of the country are both redlined in very similar ways. We have the red as the lowest grade. We have the green as the highest grade. Blue is a little below green, and then yellow is trending towards red, just so everyone has the same basis in how these were graded. Next slide, please. But of course, this wasn't sort of an issue, as LaTanya mentioned, this wasn't an issue that was restricted to just the coast or any specific cities. This was a discriminatory structure that was present in every area of the country. Here we're looking at a map of Spokane. And again, you'll see at the first grade is green, the second grade is bluish green, third grade is yellow, and fourth grade is red. And I think this is really important because from this map, it really makes it sound very official, as if there's some basis in reality for this grading. But as LaTanya mentioned, while there's like a veneer of real estate economics behind the redlining system, it didn't exist at all. Really what it was saying, the color of your skin and not your ability to repay a loan or to be a satisfactory borrower was what was driving investments in these communities. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. Next slide, please. And this next map, redlining map of Salt Lake City, even though it's a little bit lower quality, I actually think is really important to look at because really, the grading here is on a similar scale to the previous maps, but I think says in more plain language the way in which folks in both the public and private sector were grading these neighborhoods. So again, green is the best. B is still desirable. C, this is sort of a laugh so you don't cry moment, is definitely declining. and D is hazardous. So again, this is sort of, you know, very similar to those old seafaring maps where it was like, here be dragons, but except they're really outlining communities that, again, based on no real underwriting criteria, but based on the color of their skin, these are hazardous communities. These are hazardous investments, not based on any financial analysis, but just the color of their skin. Next slide, please. So next, I want to spend a little bit of time with a redlining map of Denver. Again, very similar to what we saw in terms of Spokane and Salt Lake City, Oakland and Brooklyn. But I want to use it to really kind of drive home the point that these maps, which were, you know, drafted and created almost 100 years ago, have a real direct impact today. Next slide, please. So here you'll see, you know, this map of redlining map of Denver. I think it was created in about 1938. Obviously, all of the black lines for those folks that can see the presentation, all the black lines are pointed to areas that were designated as hazardous, designated as redlined areas where insurance companies and banks were not to invest. Next slide, please. But if you fast forward about 100 years to 2018. What I have now is a map of low-income areas of Denver. And as everyone can see, those red areas and orange areas are the lowest income areas in Denver, and they correlate almost perfectly to the redlining map that was drawn almost 100 years ago. And in fact, it's only been one area that's particularly changed that went from red line to a green lined area. So again, you know, I think that there's always even from folks who are logically very cognizant of the issue and recognize that this was an issue that happened in our country's past, I think there's always a desire to say, well, we've moved beyond this. You know, these maps, while tragic at the time, really don't have bearing on anything today. And I think, as you can see, you know, a map that was drawn to show that investment wasn't supposed to go in a certain part of town has a direct impact on where low-income families live today and where underinvestment occurs today. So I think that's really important to stay cognizant of. Next slide, please. And then this isn't just limited to land use. You know, I want to zoom in quickly on back to a redlining map of Oakland. On the left side, we have a map of West Oakland that shows the area that was redlined back in the 1930s. And actually, that's the redlined area that my family's from, my grandmother grew up in and my mom grew up in. And on the right side, we have a map of internet speeds in Oakland, where the red and orange areas are where you have some of the lowest internet speeds in Oakland. And so what that's showing is that, you know, again, this redlining map that was created 100 years ago is in part directly correlated to where you have some of the lowest speeds, internet speeds in Oakland. And that really matters because, you know, where you have, and this is still a primarily low-income area, where you have low-income families who are already underserved and underinvested, you know, now during this pandemic, you know, kids are going to school, at least in the Bay Area, completely online. So you have a lot of low-income families who are not only underinvested and underserved, broadly speaking, but their kids aren't even receiving the same type of online education, again, because of a map that was drawn almost 100 years ago. So really direct reverberations today. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about how, as you know, these maps became illegal, and we, you know, obviously, as LaTanya mentioned, you can no longer redline officially areas. It still has reverberations today. Next slide, please. So here in California and in other large cities, and definitely on the West Coast and in other areas, we're experiencing a real scarcity of housing. And for anyone, as LaTanya mentioned, that read Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, one of the things he mentioned is that the best way, especially after redlining ended officially, to keep your neighborhood from changing and to keep people out of the areas where they hadn't been previously and you didn't want them now, especially people of color, the best way to do that is now with price. And so one of the ways you can do that is by limiting supply. And so in California, about 80% of our residential land is zoned so that you can only build single family residences. And it looks like in Seattle, we also have, you know, about 90%, 94% single family only zoning. And what that does is for neighborhoods that were previously redlined on those old maps, they can stay the same. And so they really limit the supply of housing, which drives up costs. And importantly, they limit the construction of multifamily apartment buildings and duplexes and triplexes, which are primarily the more common product for lower income families, especially families of color, to live in. Next slide, please. So I really am going to focus more on the impact of California, which again, primarily our land is zoned for single family only residential in about 80% of the residential land. Next slide, please. And really the impact that's had, over time is that today, we're about 2.5 to 3.5 million housing units short. And we've only built about 45% of the housing that we need, which has really driven up housing costs, especially for the working class. And families are now leaving a lot of the core areas of our cities and state overall. Next slide, please. And, obviously this is the City Club of Boise. We're not talking about California. So really, how does this have any bearing? Next slide, please. And the reason it's important is because places like Boise and Idaho in general are where Californians are moving as they're priced out. So in the same way that land use decisions and redlining maps that were created 100 years ago are still having reverberations today throughout the country, land use decisions that stem from some of that redlining, even in California, are having reverberations on our neighboring states. So as a Californian, as we grapple with our housing crisis, one of the things I want to be mindful of as we talk across state lines is the way in which our land use decisions have impacts on our neighbors and the way that land use decisions made historically, are still having reverberations today. So I'll go ahead and wrap up my comments there and hand it over to Shannon.
Thanks, Adam. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about food and redlining and localizing what all of this means for us here in Idaho. We can actually take the slides down. Morgan, I'll just speak more to this. I want to start with discussing the history of food. So agriculture was an innovation that allowed food production to happen in the places we lived. So development was focused on sedentary human civilization, moving more towards cities. So towns were selected based on natural capital and resources. So water, land to grow food and raise livestock so that we could have food surplus that enabled people to live in those city areas. So we had artisan markets, small businesses. That all started to erode before redlining. But the impacts of food are very interesting when you think about where we live. And the importance of that is where we live determines how long and how well we live. And when redlining occurred, it created a couple of things. So one, food deserts. So food deserts are labeled as areas that have limited access to affordable and nutritious food. You contrast that with areas that could be dubbed food oases, where you have supermarkets, restaurants, farmers markets, you have this area that you can go buy and purchase healthy, affordable food options. Well, food deserts, you don't get that. And then there's this other outcome, which are food swamps, which most folks haven't heard of, but that's the area where junk food is in abundance. You have fast food outlets, convenience stores, liquor stores, they outnumber the healthy food options. And food matters because people that can't afford or obtain quality food run the risk of developing chronic illness or exacerbating the illnesses they already have. So again, where you live can determine how well and how long you live. So the interesting thing about redlining and the impacts on food is there's this term, supermarket redlining as well. So grocery stores typically go in developments where demographics make sense. So that is, what is the education level? What is the income level? What is the quality of housing? And if you think about the impacts of redlining in the negative, which leads to poor health outcomes, not only in housing stock and where you live and how you make your selections on school, but also food choices. So if you think through some of the poor areas of communities that you visited nationally, I think you would be well to think back to driving through and you would see liquor stores, you would see fast food restaurants, you would see more convenience stores, you would see less grocery chains. And so grocers go where the dollars are. And so when it comes to supermarket redlining, it describes how major chain typically, and also smaller chains, supermarkets, grocers have disinterest in building locations where low income neighborhoods are. And bringing it full circle, redlining also helped create more of those low income neighborhoods and poor housing selections and the eroding and disinvestment from officials to put dollars back in those communities. And unless those neighborhoods and communities received economic and community support, it led and leads to mass gentrification. And that's really important because where you live can determine how long and well you live, your zip code. And so when you think of economic and social conditions that influence health, food is a big piece of that. Education, the physical environment, all of the economic impacts are super important. And so the movement towards equity, particularly health equity, is important because that means that everyone will have a fair opportunity to live a long and healthy life. And when we say fair, that's free from bias, discrimination, dishonesty, and prejudice, finding the right solution. Redlining's impacts are still existing today. And to bring it home for us, when we think about poverty and we think about how poverty rates are calculated, the official poverty measure is built on a threshold based on minimum food diet. Three times the cost of the minimum food diet. Food is at the heart of everything. And a local example of redlining that still has impacts today, I have two for you. So think of Boise's River Street neighborhood. So the River Street neighborhood, for those that live here, you get off the connector, you go right. So you go towards down River Street. That whole area was a red line district right here in Boise. River Street is a small corner town. It's less than 3/10 of a square mile. And it was home to Boise, Idaho's largest multiracial neighborhood, formed during the 20th century. It's one of the oldest areas of the city. And for a while, it was known as the other side of the tracks because that's the only place you could go to buy a home. We had Basque there. We had Bulgarians, Croatians, Greeks, Japanese, Russian, and it became home to the largest African-American population. And so the development of River Street over the years has changed drastically because of the way it went from a small, quiet, sleepy place to now it's an area of major thoroughfare, but it's also an area that has no real food access. The story of the River Street neighborhood is fascinating, and the city of Boise has done a great job cataloging that. The impacts of redlining are still affecting neighbors, residents of that area to this day because of a lack of food access, because of quality options. And it's a very interesting place to visit because there's only one single family home from that era that stands today. And it's tied to a beautiful story around Irma Hayman, who was born in 1907 in Nampa, Idaho. In 1948, her and her husband, after racial discrimination, could only buy a house in that neighborhood. So 1617 Ash Street. Irma was a vital advocate for her neighborhood and the residents that lived there. And she remained in that neighborhood until the ripe old age of 102. She passed away in 2009, and her home was acquired by the city of Boise. And it actually is in development to be preserved and rebooted, if you will, restored, because it's the last single family home on the block. So it's a testament to not only what redlining's impacts were, taking that story to home. Irma's story is representative of the everyday story of that time. And thinking through redlining and what that did for Idahoans and the impacts today are still some areas that we're working to reverse. And so food, again, if you think about chronic disease and illness and needing to see a doctor and to be treated, if the neighborhood doesn't have access to good, affordable, healthy food, what might happen? If the neighborhood doesn't have a built infrastructure that allows for walking and moving about, what might happen? So redlining, not only from a housing perspective, but from an economic and health perspective, still has lasting impacts to this day. So I feel like that was a semester's worth of information in about 5 to 7 minutes. I will pass it back off to you, Jen, to get us going on some questions, see what folks are thinking.
Yeah, just thank you so much to the three of you for taking the time and care to present that history and that context for all of us. Extremely informative and helpful. And we have questions pouring in from our audience, actually. Before we get to those, I just want to remind our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation on redlining, featuring Adam Briones, LaTanya Haney-Keith, and Shannon McGuire. All right, let's jump into some of these audience questions. There's a lot of questions about Boise in particular, and Shannon, you talked some about River Street. One of the questions that came through, a listener wants to know, how did redlining, or how does sort of its reverberations today impact Idaho businesses' ability to attract new residents and new talent, high quality employees here? Shannon, you're nodding. Do you have a perspective on sort of what this might mean in terms of our business community?
Yeah, a bit there. So when you think about neighborhoods that were redlined and you look at it from just the holistic view, the quality of schools. So a lot of folks that come and businesses that choose to relocate, they look at schools, they look at what are the qualities of schools, what is the quality of housing, what's the transportation like, what's the quality of life in terms of green areas and where to go. Food is another one. So all of those what are dubbed social determinants of health, but they get remixed with the economic lens. Again, where you live, how long, and how well you live. So when it comes to businesses relocating, the first thing that folks think of, where can I buy a home? Where do I live? Where do I raise my family? What schools do I put them in and place them in? And so some of the opportunities that are missed could be because of areas that are low income areas, and they may have been redlined areas and don't paint a holistic picture. And not just Boise, if we think of the Treasure Valley, I mean, Nampa has areas that were redlined as well as Caldwell. And to bring Nampa home a bit more, there are also areas of Nampa that face 30 years of generational poverty. So again, if you look at the holisticness of a neighborhood at the neighborhood level, representative of a city, major businesses or even smaller businesses, determination on where they go are based on a lot of the things that are negatively impacted by redlining.
Thank you. Latanya, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to maybe just frame it too in this kind of concept of thinking about diverse talent, right? And now kind of as Adam mentioned in terms of the ability for, we talked about accumulation of wealth, and then we've talked now even about the lack of affordable housing. We now have a significant portion of our diverse talent, fantastic talent, that is having to move further and further out. Now that we're rebuilding Boise, we look at the cost of homes here, we look at the cost of rents here, are having to move further and further out, but we don't have the transportation infrastructure to allow those individuals to come back in where most of the additional businesses are developing, right? And so I also think about it as, you know, kind of the intersection between wealth accumulation and talent, the diversity of talent that businesses could draw on, great, fantastic Idahoans that can't actually get down to Boise because of the lack of transportation in light of the impacts of redlining.
Yeah, thank you so much. Adam, a question for you. There's a lot of questions about gentrification that are coming in. And I wonder, Shannon talked about this some, but could you connect for us from your perspective, you know, the history of redlining to some of the gentrifying trends we're seeing today? How do you think about those processes?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, if I could, just on the small business question, one other issue I'd like to bring up is not just, you know, who small businesses can attract to an area, but also just, you know, during this pandemic, since I believe February, approximately 40% of African-American owned businesses have closed and have just gone out of business. And so that's really impacting sort of the small business demographics of a city, of cities throughout the nation. And we see that as a real, you know, direct impact from redlining and historical wealth stripping from communities of color, because many of those small businesses, because of the racial wealth gap, didn't have the same type of economic cushion that many other businesses did to sort of ride out that period before the stimulus checks came in, or were not able to access stimulus checks, period. As many of you know, for every dollar that was requested by African-American or Latino-owned businesses, only about 10 cents came from the federal government in terms of the stimulus program. So I just wanted to throw that out there because I think it's a really important point. But in terms of gentrification, let me speak specifically to my experience in land use in California, which I understand is not a one-to-one comparison, but I think at a high level, there's certainly, I think, takeaways that are you know, can be extrapolated to a lot of different areas. One of the issues we've seen in California specific to redlining is that the areas, well, it's two things. One is that the areas that are currently you're able to develop in, are generally lower income communities that have historically been, home to communities of color for generations. This wasn't an issue as cities were shrinking and folks were moving to the suburbs. But as people have been moving back to the center city, as more jobs have been moving back downtown, and as sort of core city real estate has become more and more expensive, the only areas in which developers can really build multifamily and sort of meet the growing demand is in these areas where previously there had been no real demand, both either on the development side or on the renter side. And so the issue we're seeing, especially in California, is that, to the extent that only communities of color are able to really absorb this development, that's really a lot of what is driving gentrification, because that's where the new product can go. As long as whiter, wealthier areas and neighborhoods are sort of not open for development and not open for growth, that growth is always going to be pushed to communities of color. So that's one of the big issues that we're thinking about in California.
So this is a follow-up question, and really I think any of you on the panel could answer it, but Adam, we'll start with you. It's a sophisticated question about, given that gentrification is happening, how do we develop policy that helps minority communities, for example, build equity when the lines between those communities that need that assistance and gentrifying communities are blurred? In other words, how do you direct policy or direct aid to the right people to right some of these inequities?
Sure. So I'll be brief, because I think there's probably a lot of great comments from LaTanya and Shannon. But I think first and foremost, as LaTanya mentioned, the real specific impact of redlining is that communities of color were not allowed to build wealth in the same way that the rest of the country was able to in a very specific time period in our history. We were denied ability to own homes and purchase homes. And we were also denied the ability to take out small business loans. And on top of that, we weren't able to access the same type of higher education subsidies that many other families were through the GI Bill. So I think first and foremost, if we're going to directly address the impact of redlining, we have to talk about how we can bring more wealth building opportunities to communities of color that experience that redlining. And I think that in terms of fairness, that is one thing that we really need to be addressing. And I think when you consider that, just a few months ago, the Federal Reserve and Treasury, injected $2.2 trillion into the economy, I think the answer of we don't have the money to do it is no longer realistic. I think that we've shown that where there's a will, there's a way. And that as we can more directly support home ownership, small business ownership, and other wealth building activities, I think that's one of the most important steps we can take.
Yeah, thank you so much. LaTanya, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, this is so really complex, right? We're talking about nearly a century of systemic kind of segregation and housing related to housing policy. And so how do you really think about the solutions? And I think Adam's point is brilliant. Like, how do we kind of reverse time and think about how to build that wealth accumulation? So some of that is really complex. Some of that too is related to now kind of dismantling that segregated housing policy. There's lots of ideas that are on the table. We've touched on a few of these, right? So some of it's banning exclusionary zoning that are prohibiting multifamily housing. That's something that, we've been looking here in Boise. The CCDC has been looking at kind of the reverse of that, supporting inclusionary zoning, right? Allowing more affordable housing choices, allowing for that multifamily housing to be built so that we've got a differentiation between wealth in various communities. And so those are two areas, I think, that we could expand, but there's many, many others, right? There's the affirmatively further fair housing rule that was adopted by the Obama administration. And there's been some movement to want to reinvigorate that rule. And that focuses on a provision of the Fair Housing Act that requires jurisdictions, if they're receiving federal funds, to really affirmatively further the purpose of that law, right? Really understanding where we've got reducing the concentrated areas of poverty and remedy those segregated conditions. There's also a concept about fair share, coming up with a national fair share act. Some of the states are already doing this, or municipalities are doing that, with fair share requirements based on income in terms of housing, to kind of diversify the housing stock and to start to reintegrate neighborhoods. But there's a lot of complexity there. And that kind of starting with what Adam noted, the problem in many respects is wealth. the ability to actually buy a home, even if we can expand a kind of our zoning laws, is really how do we ensure that communities of color in particular have the wealth in order to actually get into the housing market and begin to accumulate wealth at a rate that our Caucasian counterparts have been able to do over the last many decades.
Shannon, we're getting questions for you about how we might target food solutions in particular to some of these communities. So there's questions about food deserts, about bodegas, for example, which have gotten a lot of attention in the press, the Healthy Food Financing Initiative under the Obama administration. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of these more targeted programs or solutions that are an attempt to redress some of these inequalities.
Yeah, I'll tie it to the last question as well, because when it comes to equity, I think we have to be mindful that it's finding the right solution, and localizing equity matters, and localizing it at the city level and down to the neighborhood level. And when it comes to food in particular, local is hot, right? We're on this kick of grow local, be local, buy local. And sometimes the sad part is local is not always affordable. Land is gone. And so now it's how we grow food, where the tech innovations around food growth is really important. I think that it's interesting, right? I do work across the state, and I've heard mixed reviews, mostly positive, around municipalities' role in food. It's not our job. It's not our thing to do. I politely argue that as a city, food resilience is huge. At the neighborhood level, food is huge. And so I think in addition to always looking at things from the federal level, how do we localize that conversation in a way that we understand the benefits and burdens at the neighborhood level and look at that city? Because sometimes here in Idaho, a neighborhood is representative of an entire rural community. And so linking with food growers is going to be important. The food system I love is because it's something that you can look at and you can figure out an entry point. So how do we subsidize more growing of great food? And that's a big conversation, getting away from just commodity crops to how do we get fresh fruits and vegetables on the table? At the same time, balancing the economic impacts that farmers get livable wages. That's a whole other topic. And so then how do we get that food accessible? And bodegas in some form, shape are interesting, but food supply issues are always hot, because once we centralized our supermarket chains and we have these district and regional warehouses, your carrot is traveling like over 1,000 miles to get here. So I think I would say, as much as we can localize conversation around food and food tech, food subsidy, how do we get farming back as a core occupation? How do we get food growth at the neighborhood level back in conversation in ways that are modernized and where we are? Because sometimes we can't wait for the federal government to save us. I mean, food resilience at the city and neighborhood level, those are some exciting policies I would love to see come forth.
Thank you, Shannon. I want to welcome our radio listeners who are listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Adam Briones, LaTanya Haney-Keith, and Shannon McGuire, who are talking about redlining. We have a few interesting questions coming in about schools and education. One question about worried about teachers who may not be able to afford housing near where they are supposed to teach, for example. And another one asking about school funding, which is based on property tax, and the way those might exacerbate redlining trends or inequities. LaTanya, did you want to by any chance speak to the impact of schools and how we fund education?
Oh my goodness, that is such a huge topic, but such an important one. And you're exactly right. I mean, where we lived and the way in which we've developed policies and how we fund our school system has really, you know, really been a huge impact with respect to redlining. And I think Adam's, you know, map showed perfectly. We talked about the broadband, right? The internet access is a huge issue today. And if we put that overlay on top of just any resources associated with our educational system, that's been a huge issue that we're still trying to tackle. How do we dismantle that now, right? How, again, because we've really built in this infrastructure, how do we dismantle that? You know, when we think about kind of Brown versus Board of Education and integrating schools and busing. We did a huge amount of that right after that decision. And we've now somewhat retracted from that approach. Not to say that was necessarily the right approach, right? But we've retracted from that. And we're now really more speaking about the localizing. We've now gone to more of this neighborhood school approach. But the neighborhood school is based on where you live, is funded based on where you live. And unfortunately, we're seeing kind of poverty and race overlap quite significantly. So the funding associated with education is really, you know, trending to, you know, this, again, this point about even wealth accumulation. How do we even get our children to be able to break through, have that level of social mobility and break through that when we don't have the level of education or the wealth to even have them break out of that cycle of poverty? So it's a really complex issue. And I certainly don't have any of the answers about how we're going to fix that. But it really is both thinking about it nationally and, to Shannon's point, thinking about it locally. How do we start breaking these systemic institutionalized processes that we've put ourselves in this position? And we're coming up, I think, on another crisis, both housing crisis and education crisis, because it's very true that most of the teachers, given the wage, talking about living wage for farm workers, the living wage for teachers, are not able to even live in the areas in which they are teaching. It's a cycle that we need to find probably a pretty complex, but a really kind of unique, maybe creative solutions in order to continue to break down those kind of systemic processes we put in place.
Thank you. Sure. You know, I very much agree with everything that LaTanya mentioned. And I know, just looking, I was looking at some market data. I think rents in Boise are up about 53% over the past decade. So certainly, I think a lot of the issues that we face in California, you know, are just a lot more common in other parts of the country. You know, as our cities grow, as frankly, unfortunately, wages stay stagnant, and as housing costs go up. And one of the real issues we grapple with in California is that, you know, certainly there is a robust affordable housing finance system across the country through the low-income housing tax credit program that, while it needs to be greatly expanded and greatly increased, it at least exists. But for those folks that are, say, teachers, or they're in a you know, middle-class union, or they're working class but not quite low income, or you have a two income household, neither of whom makes a lot of money, but you're not at a low income, under 60% of area median income rate, you know, there's really not a lot of government support there. And we find, especially for communities of color, the conception often is that we're only very low or low income. But, you know, in a lot of neighborhoods, you have folks that have a two income household that, while they're not making a lot, you have a nurse and perhaps a teacher, or maybe someone that has a good union job. They're not making a lot of money, but you know, they're not low income, and there's really not a lot of support for them. The housing market rate housing is out of their reach, and government subsidy isn't targeted to them. So what we find is that they're having to move further and further away from jobs and schools, and it's having a real impact. And so I think that going forward, you know, housing advocates and equity advocates, it's something that we should really be paying attention to.
LaTanya, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, you know, in particular, taking a look at Idaho, you know, before pre-COVID, right? Pre-COVID, I think, you know, we had a pretty low unemployment rate. And I think in some ways it was a little bit deceptive in the sense that we are also the country with one of the lowest minimum wages in the country, and also with the highest percentage of individuals in lower wage jobs. So, you know, even though we had a pretty strong employment here in the state, we had a huge sector of our population that are making more low, moderate incomes. But we're seeing such growth, particularly here in Boise, and the cost of houses and the cost of renting has been, and that's where a lot of my work in the housing clinic previously has been, the cost of renting is just astronomical. And so we are seeing this wave of individuals having to move out of Boise much further and further away without transportation, as I mentioned earlier, but can't get back down to for jobs. And so we're seeing this, you know, this continued trend of that lack of ability to continue to build wealth, right, to save, to do the things that need to happen in order to allow for that social mobility. And that's just a cycle that I'm hoping that we can continue to talk about here locally to try and break that cycle.
Thanks, LaTanya. Adam, I'm just going to kick it back to you. You had talked about housing availability in your opening remarks, how we haven't been building enough housing and certainly not enough affordable housing. There's a question here, and there's been a lot of concern in Boise in particular about the role that short-term rentals play in affecting housing availability and housing affordability. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. And I'll preface with saying that short-term rentals are not a specific focus of mine, but I do know that there is some research out there, especially I think in Los Angeles, that shows there's a real impact of short-term rentals on housing costs. I would say that, you know, part of that is because in areas where you have high demand and restricted supply, especially, and you have a land use structure that somewhat limits your ability to create sort of, you know, hotel style development, you know, that sort of is what happens. And I think a lot of that, it really can be tied back to a scarcity of housing. And as long as you have a scarcity, when you have high demand, anytime you're taking units off the market for short-term rental, you're going to be driving up the cost. You're going to be driving down vacancy and driving up occupancy, which creates a scarcity, and it lowers competition between landlords. So I think, you know, while there's definitely some, you know, definitely research out there that shows the impact of short-term rentals, it's really a symptom to me and not the underlying cause of the issue.
Thank you so much. We are nearing the end of our conversation today, but I wanted to do a kind of a lightning round to end things. So maybe give each of you a minute to speak about what you think the most powerful action we could take to address and reverse the impacts of historic redlining would be. So this is your magic wand question. If you're given a magic wand and you could pick one sort of policy solution or answer to these issues, what would you pick? So LaTanya, we'll start with you.
Oh goodness, you're giving everyone else time to think here. There's so many things I'd love to do, but I guess, you know, my focus has really been in that affordable housing piece. I think we really need to be thinking here, at least locally, about how, you know, the kind of not in my backyard, you know, concept really needs to, we need to kind of bring that culture in of wanting to take care of our Idahoans and to find ways to ensure that we've got affordable housing for our community, I think, is critical. That's kind of the work I'm looking at through the lens on the CCDC here in Boise. And that's really what I'd like to see us move in that direction in light of the growth as we've seen California's, as Adam said, moving here. And there's lots of growth here, but we can't forget, you know, that there's a range of individuals who we might be leaving behind if we don't solve that issue here.
Thank you so much. Shannon, how about you?
I think about the humanness in all of this, and I'm a fan of policy and systems and environment for sure. Everything comes back to humans, and I think that the community context is huge. And I'm a Pollyanna, right? And I think that the more people feel good about being themselves, and if we can come from, with that lens to reshape our policy, our environments, and our systems, I would love for us to be able to sit down in a room and come up with solutions that actually work. How can we get all the players together, including those with the lived experience, in a room to address the adverse community environments, the adverse cultural expectations, and turn them into advantages? So what might happen if we sat down and actually listened to one another, had a conversation, broke bread, and then came up with some solutions? So I would like to take the most opposing views, get them together over a meal, and let's have a restorative conversation on how we can move forward. That's my Pollyanna.
Thank you so much. And Adam.
Well, first, I would do exactly what Shannon and LaTanya said to do. I prioritize that. And then second, I would think about how we can use our country's monetary policy, specifically through the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, to counteract some of what have been, you know, almost 100 years of reverberations of systemic discrimination and redlining. And in particular, you know, treat the racial wealth gap the same way that we treat inflation. We need to solve for it, and we have the tools to do it.
Well, on behalf of City Club, our audience, our listeners, I want to thank you so much, Adam Briones, LaTanya Haney-Keith, and Shannon McGuire, for participating in today's discussion about redlining. It's just an excellent conversation. We appreciate your time. And thanks so much to those of you at home listening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.